morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Memorial Day USA ominously looms with the specter of 100,000 plus American citizens dead and many, many more yet to sicken and die in a worldwide pandemic that has only just begun. This Memorial Day of plague should first and foremost eulogize the most recent dead of this catastrophic world war, in which multitudes who are about to die might be any one of us. It is ironically appropriate that we who might also sicken and die should feel empathetically obliged to honor the already dead and place wreaths around their memories, just as occurred on Memorial Days amidst the old world wars of remembrance while they were yet being waged. And we who are yet living should especially honor those who have died in the course of attempting to save lives, the medical women and men who have truly sacrificed themselves in the line of duty, and all others who have been in the forefront of epidemical combat and for whom there is yet no foreseeable end in sight. And now, an article written by Juliet Kayyem, Trump turned the death count into a story about himself. She wrote this for the New York Times. And she, by the way, was former Department of Homeland Security official, and she is the author of Security Mom. How many dead? Only after coronavirus have claimed more than 60,000 lives, Donald Trump's previous estimate for how many Americans might die, did the president acknowledge that the toll could rise to 100,000. The projections keep changing, and the question of whether authorities are even counting correctly looms ever larger. The United States has a duty to make an accurate tally, and not just because Americans need to know how many people to grieve. Why do people die? This isn't just a philosophical or religious question. For crisis response experts, it also has tactical implications. Why did that person die while this person didn't? Attributing a fatality to an earthquake, hurricane, or some other catastrophe explains only so much, because people experiencing these events do so in widely varied ways. To know what ended someone's life may help give their family peace, but it also teaches the living how to spare others the same fate. We learn from the dead. Recently, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that a large number of excess deaths, quote unquote, occurred across 5 weeks in March and April. Even excluding deaths already attributed to the coronavirus, states hit hard by the pandemic have recorded many more fatalities than normal. Thousands of Americans may have died of undiagnosed COVID-19 because they could not or did not get medical treatment. Were any of these deaths the result of shortages of personal protective equipment? Could any of them be tied to travel or attendance at so-called super spreader events? Would closer adherence to social distancing rules have saved them? Without knowing what happened in these cases, experts miss out on potentially life-giving insights. The passage of time may bring clarity, or not. After the Tampa Bay Times found that Florida's medical examiners were reporting 10% more COVID-19 deaths than the state health department was, the latter intervened to muzzle the former. After the White House indicated that it would disband its coronavirus task force, Trump abandoned the idea, but the trial balloon clearly underscored his desire to make the problem go away rather than reckon honestly with what has happened. Sure enough, Axios reported that Trump thinks the death toll, now past 80,000, has been exaggerated. To Americans' great misfortune, their president has a way of turning everything, absolutely everything, into a commentary on his own performance. Death counts are no exception. Previously, Trump insisted that 60,000 to 70,000 deaths would be a victory relative to the 2.2 million that some models predicted. He all but forces the public to look at the numbers in similar Trump-centric terms. In an interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, Deborah Birx, finally rejected Trump's rosy projections. "Our projections have always been between 100,000 and 240,000 American lives lost," she said. "And that's with full mitigation and us learning from each other of how to social distance." When I heard that, I caught myself thinking, "We told you so." I am among those who are alarmed by Trump's handling of the pandemic and believe that the country's failure to enact anything close to full mitigation, that is, a national shutdown accompanied by widespread testing and contact tracing, has needlessly endangered a lot of people. But "we told you so" is a Trumpian way of thinking. It presumes that somehow everything about American life is a competition between two teams, that even body counts are numbers on a scoreboard, and that one side loses and one side wins. The more the numbers shift around and become politicized, the easier they are for the American public to tune out. In Puerto Rico, after Hurricane Maria in 2017, the official death toll was initially reported at 64, then revised to nearly 3,000. Harvard researchers published an estimate of 4,645. Can anyone on the mainland truly understand the tragedy? The lingering question marks are a perceptual barrier. Likewise, the projected death counts being bandied about during the coronavirus pandemic, while enormous, also sound speculative. 100,000 deaths, 240,000, 2.2 million, that Trump and others who are insisting on a quick reopening can ignore them. When experts learn from the dead, they can save lives in the future. In 1978, a massive blizzard hit the eastern seaboard, pounding the region with heavy snow for a remarkable 33 hours. By the end, about 100 people were killed and another 4,500 injured. Some of those casualties had surprising causes. After traffic on Interstate 95 stalled and commuters huddled in their cars, more than a dozen people died of carbon monoxide poisoning, because the snow had piled up fast enough to cover their exhaust pipes. That experience helps explain why, when major winter storms are predicted, governors across New England initiate travel bans early on. In 2004, a major earthquake, measuring at 9.1 in magnitude and lasting more than 8 minutes, shook the ocean floor off the coast of northern Sumatra, Indonesia. Massive tsunami waves in the Indian Ocean, some 100 feet high, headed toward the shore. Across 14 countries, more than 225,000 people would perish. Accounts by experts and journalists suggest that distance from the shore wasn't the only factor that determined who lived and who died. When a tsunami forms, it draws water from the shoreline that recedes dramatically. For some people near the water, this was a curiosity. For others, it was an omen. The former stayed put, the latter dispersed. How did they know to flee? Researchers found intriguing patterns. Many older, more established communities had higher survival rates. Residents had learned, via accounts passed on from generation to generation, of previous tsunamis, including several devastating ones from the early 20th century. Unlike recent immigrants or Western travelers staying at fancy hotels, many who survived benefited from a civic understanding grounded in what their ancestors had experienced. Today, the nations stricken by the 2004 tsunami have coastal alert systems and post-educational materials at immigration offices, airports, and hotels, explaining what many didn't know in 2004. When the water recedes, run for the hills. One other tragedy holds a lesson for our current one. In 2005, most of the city of New Orleans was inundated when its levees failed. After George W. Bush pushed his hapless FEMA administrator out, he put Admiral Thad Allen, the former commandant of the Coast Guard, in charge of overseeing the federal emergency management effort. In an interview a decade later, I asked him to reflect on the point when he felt that he had a grip on the situation and assumed the answer might be the return of fresh water, food, or electricity. Without missing a beat, he said the turning point was when his team could identify and tend to the dead. When we had done that, he told me, I felt it was time to look at long-term recovery. Making sense of the deaths that have occurred during the coronavirus pandemic is just as important. During the pandemic, the U.S. has appeared broken, unable to respond in a manner worthy of so mighty a nation. A proper accounting provides more than a modicum of closure. The dead can still speak to us, and when the next virus comes, guide us toward how to do better. And that was Trump Turned the Death Count into a Story About Himself by Juliette Kayyem, who is a former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under President Obama, and she is the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is the author of Security Mom, an unclassified guide to protecting our homeland and your home. She wrote this for The Atlantic magazine. I mischaracterized it as the New York Times. I beg your pardon. And for we North Pacific Coast inhabitants, the experience of the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami is eminently instructive. Pay attention to the experiences of past inhabitants. And a poem by Josephine Jacobson, Ghosts at Quezon. Under the bullets, the babies of the Sioux tumble. The babies crumble like clay. The squaws stumble and try to crawl. The wigwams blaze like comets in the snow. The children fall, painting it. Their ghosts blow like smoke over Quezon. Ghost to familiar ghost. The huts burn like shabby suns. The sons and daughters lie where they fell running. The women cannot move to touch before they join the confused blowing ghosts. Over the ditch, the air is full of ghosts, given up. Is it a prairie, snowy wood, or paddy field and dust to dust? Where is its name? How shall we tell? The faces of the strangers are the same. And now, something I wrote. Memorial Day should be a day of shame for Donald Trump. He cravenly dodged the Vietnam War with a fake claim of bone spur disability, later boasting about his heroic combat against catching venereal disease, and that military school was his equivalency to war service. He did not evade Vietnam as a matter of conscience or principle, but simply from a privileged desire to bribe his precious self out of harm's way. Although many years later, he ingenuously proclaimed that he would have been proud to serve in Vietnam, as though it were no fault of his that he didn't. By then, he was commander-in-chief of the American war machine as president of the USA. Yet imagine an alternative if he had not been able to avoid combat service in Vietnam. The sort of soldier he most likely might have been if his current corrupt instability is a clue. The most stark possibility would be outright cowardice under fire, such as abandoning his comrades in a firefight and later lying about it. His malign cowardice might have caused decimation of whatever outfit he was with. He might have been a William Calley, murdering unarmed peasant women and children in a deja vu village resembling My Lai. He most certainly would have got himself involved in the notorious military black market that seriously corrupted America's role in Vietnam. He might have been a turncoat deserter. Whatever else he might have done, whether as officer or enlisted, he would have created chaos and deadly disorder. Everything he might have been a part of would turn into military disaster. and he would have lied about everything and scapegoated everybody. As mentioned, there is abundant probability of betrayal to save his own neck. Now, leap forward half a century. He is dodging his presidential responsibilities with the Pangolian plague, shoving all necessary crisis response and liabilities upon state governors, whom he undercuts and publicly vilifies. They are not only forced to take the rap for the all that goes wrong, he wraps them with his failure, his scorn, his dishonesty, and lies. He is concerned only with himself and his personal wealth and reelection. To such a malevolent and malignant degeneracy that he falsely insists it is his right as president to send millions of Americans into contaminated spheres of employment to save Wall Street and the unsteady stock market, which he equates with his primal quest for reelection. Trump is not only narcissistically addicted to himself as despot, he is also viscerally aware defeat means prison for crimes committed as president, which he is currently, though wrongfully, not to be indicted for while president, a pernicious oversight that needs rectifying. Treacheries and corruption, large and small, are a hallmark of Donald Trump. The great Jewish Prime Minister of Victorian England, Benjamin Disraeli, aptly described Trump when he said of a political opponent that he was a systematic liar and beggarly cheat, a swindler and poltroon. He has committed every crime that does not require courage. And that was Disraeli. Perhaps the General-in-Chief Trump might have his cherished military parade on Memorial Day with the 100,000 and counting American plague dead zombie marching past the White House. And now, somewhat in the same vein, an article by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, Stupidity Run Amok. I agree with Englishman John Cleese, who insists that too many Americans are stupid. Only 2 of 5 Americans can identify the 3 branches of government. Only 25% can name more than 1 of the 5 freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. And just 1 generation ago, presidential speeches were pitched at the level of 12th graders. Today, they're pitched at the level of 7th graders. In 1999, psychologists David Dunning and Justin Kruger coined the Dunning-Kruger effect, whereby people who are stupid are unable to recognize their own stupidity. Stupid Americans don't think it's bad to be stupid. Far from being ashamed, they seem proud of it. Our moronitude is regrettably unique. England, winner of the 1986 dwarf-tossing world championship, never had a political party called the Know-Nothings. But we did in 1855. And when contemporary historians reference the Know-Nothings, few chortle in derision, but nod knowingly. From the 1994 screwball comedy, Dumb and Dumber, to Green Day's punk rock opera, American Idiot, to the cult film, Idiocracy, our cultural commentators take repeated stabs at our dumb and proud national attitude. Many well-read men and women believe things that can't possibly be true, like the Earth isn't 4.54 billion years old, but a mere 6,024. Could it be? Drum roll, please. The Earth was formed at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, October 23rd, 4000 B.C., as claimed by Matthew Harrison Brady, representing fundamentalist William Jennings Bryan in the 1955 play Inherit the Wind. Thought you curious listeners might want to know that. And it was a wonderful film also. I mostly blame our schools for our flourishing stupidity. We learn facts, but not how to think and evaluate. Debate and logical reasoning are after-school activities. So we grow up believing everyone is entitled to their opinion, each as valid as any other, even though that can't possibly be true. Face it, Americans are ignoramuses, ill-informed, apathetic, and easily manipulated. So how can we curb galloping stupidity? We should reintroduce civics as a mandatory subject in grade school, high school, and college. We should stop rewarding rich, rapacious cretins. We should repudiate climate change and evolution deniers. We should require armed protesters who too adamantly insist we should open up the country in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic to wear cowbells. We should encourage everyone to read credible newspapers and embrace fact-based radio and TV programs. We should laugh more, a powerful inoculator against stupidity. And we should participate in democracy parties, social gatherings where issues are intelligently discussed. That's probably just wishful thinking. I'm not optimistic that we can significantly reduce our prevailing stupidity. But we can be a much better country, not ignorantly railing against what we oppose, but championing what we value. And that requires abundant intelligence, not copious stupidity. While we're all sometimes stupid, we need to reduce others' surging stupidity, convincing as many as possible that it's really bad to be stupid. But I could be wrong. Wait a minute. I hear some chants. Lock her up. Send her back. Build that wall. USA. USA. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake, just across the river from Astoria in Ocean Park, Washington. Stupidity run amok. And now, on a personal note, a few years ago, sometime after my mother's death, I started writing down the names and memories of dead people I had known. It might seem to have been a morbid exercise, but it helped ground me to the frailty of life, which is especially germane during this pandemic period of mass mortality. Most of us in so-called normal times seem to move too quickly beyond people we knew after their deaths, as if they occupied an inaccessibly remote past that has little measure for the zoom of present and future. I felt compelled to capture them in amber before remembrance of them was forgotten. As I remembered them, I wrote miniature biographies of each and especially noted what I felt about them. Those whose names I inscribed did not include my deceased family members. That is another commemoration. And very few I knew who were killed in Vietnam. With only a few exceptions of close friends who were KIA in Vietnam, I have forgotten the names of so many others because they were so many and our acquaintances so brief. But I have a book with their names that I purchased at the Vietnam Wall when it was dedicated Armistice Day, 1982, which I have since called the American Book of the Dead, nearly equivalent to collecting dog tags. Most of my other deceased friends were ordinary people who died in ordinary ways. A few murdered or committed suicide, in particular Vietnam vets. A few drug overdoses, many in accidents of one sort or another. Many more from assorted medical causes, from illness, heart attacks, cancer, or medical errors. Some were quite old. One friend lived 102, and his life spanned 3 centuries. And others were quite young, including children and even infants, whose sum of life would have to be measured in breaths. My body count was nearly 300. I wrote them as I remembered them, often scribbling on bar napkins or whatever scrap of something to write on as I remembered someone or someone mentioned another dead someone we knew in tandem. My memoir memory went dim after a while. Others I knew have died since, and I try to remember to add their names. So far, the pandemic has not added newer names, but that might be only temporary. Friends who died of AIDS are the only victims of an epidemic on my necrologue, but I sadly predict that will soon change. It is also probably my own name will be the last on my register of mortal departures, if I am able to scribble it before I go blank. I end this program with a poem by Oregon's immortal poet laureate, William Stafford. Walking Away, an Undeclared War. Once where we lived, every place in the sky, always followed its exact earth place. Now we are poor at the wolf's door, and we climb from the river, holding onto bird songs. Now, while we walk the streets of our town, we have hundreds and hundreds of ways to know the killing we know the minutes make all through the warm night as we walk. And we hear the mockingbirds on the chimneys or tops of trees in the moonlight, hunting down the center of our lives and singing to save the state. This is Michael McCusker. This Memorial Day weekend, which is also the advent of the annual summer silly season, might be the first real trial event of opening up the USA for business as usual amidst the raging pathogenic plague that is killing more Americans than the last several wars. Hot tourist destinations, such as local coastal areas, are especially vulnerable to cluster contagion if people use this holiday weekend to pack the beaches. The onerous habit of commercializing specific national commemorations into three-day holiday festivities that play America's song on cash registers from coast to coast might just boomerang this Memorial Day, in which the sideshow of honoring war dead abundantly fertilizes the pandemic that plagues all our houses, the sultans of fun are apparently ignoring in their rush for seasonal gold. So remember the imperative axiom that protecting yourself protects everyone else, and that personal freedom does not give anyone the right to endanger or inflict harm on anyone else purposely or heedlessly. Happy Memorial Day.